This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with D.C. attorney Mara Verheyden Hilliard about much of her litigation concerning protesters and First Amendment rights.
Mara and her partner, Carl Massinio, have set up the Partnership for Civil Justice, which has won some extraordinary lawsuits ever since the mid-90s. This is quite an interview.
We'll talk with attorney and union activist Daniel Gross about his recent book, Labor Law for the Rank and Filer.
Daniel came out of retail organizing, was instrumental working with the IWW in organizing Starbucks, and now he's teamed up with the famous Stoughton Lind to write a book whose subtitle, Building Solidarity While Staying Clear of the Law, is just an extraordinary offering to those of us who believe in social change from the bottom up.
Stay with us. We have a few updates today. Last week, the National Lawyers Guild called on Israel to release 15 Palestinian fishermen and three internationals who were seized in Palestinian waters by the Israeli Navy on November 18th. Israel's seizure of these individuals violates international law, the Oslo Accords, and the law of the seas. Last week, Israeli forces confronted fishermen and human rights observers located in three separate boats just 7 miles off the coast of Deir al-Balah. These ships were sailing well within Gaza's fishing waters, as detailed in the Oslo Accords of 1994. International observers have been accompanying Palestinian fishermen who are regularly attacked by Israeli naval vessels. Last week, the three internationals on board were Andrew Munsey from Scotland, Darlene Wallach from the United States, and Victor Arrigoni from Italy. They have been volunteering with the International Solidarity Movement since they entered Gaza with the first Free Gaza Movement voyage on August 23rd. Fellow activists have been unable to establish contact with the observers or with the fishermen since they were abducted. The Guild, in particular, is concerned that these observers and fishermen will be subjected to torture and denied access to counsel while in Israeli custody. The Guild condemned the blockade of Gaza's ports, as well as the illegal harassment of Palestinian fishermen. Patrols and attacks from the Israeli Navy regularly occur as little as 3 miles from shore. Over 70 fishermen were arrested by Israeli forces over the past year. The illegal limits on the passage of Palestinian fishermen have reduced the average catch of fish from 3,000 tons a year in the 90s to just 500 tons today. This harassment signals that Israel continues to occupy Gazan territory in breach of the current ceasefire and prior claims of, quote, disengagement. Over 40,000 people in Gaza make a living from the fishing industry. Yet this community has been decimated by Israeli restrictions on fishing rights and the prevention of fuel from reaching the Gaza Strip. Recently, the UK-based aid agency Oxfam warned that Gaza faces a humanitarian disaster unless Israel's blockade is lifted. Previously, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called on Israel to swiftly allow food aid and fuel supply lines to be reopened for Gaza. Last week, a South Texas grand jury indicted Vice President Dick Cheney and former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez on charges related to the alleged abuse of prisoners in Willacy County's federal detention centers. The indictment criticized Cheney's investment in the Vanguard Group, which has an interest in the private prison companies running the federal detention centers in Texas. The indictment accuses Cheney of a conflict of interest and, quote, at least misdemeanor assaults on detainees by working through the prison companies. Gonzalez is accused of using his position while in office to stop an investigation into abuses at the federal detention centers. Another indictment charges State Senator Eddie Lucio Jr. with profiting from his public office by accepting honoraria from prison management companies. Charlotte Dennett of Vermont, who ran for state attorney general on the platform that she would undertake the prosecution of George W. Bush for unnecessary deaths of Vermont soldiers in Iraq, while her campaign didn't win, we expect to see other efforts like this brought around states throughout the nation. the last two presidential inaugurations in Washington, D.C., seats open to the public were extremely limited and were controlled by the Presidential Inauguration Committee. After a legal challenge to effectively reopen Pennsylvania Avenue to all Americans, the seat numbers have greatly increased and will no longer be controlled by a political party. We have with us today Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice Legal Defense and Education Fund, and on the legal team composed of Partnership for Civil Justice and National Lawyers Guild members that sued Philadelphia officials for having sometimes, quote, used city regulations to dissuade members of controversial political groups and causes from holding public demonstrations. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, welcome once again to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
Mara, you've got the most extraordinary practice, you and your partner, Carl, down in D.C. What went into your thinking about what kind of lawyer you wanted to be and the kind of practice that you and Carl set up?
Well, as you said, Carl Massinio and I co-founded the Partnership for Civil Justice in the mid-90s, and we formed this organization and this public interest law firm because we wanted to be able to carry out very particular work on behalf of people in the United States, people who are not being served in other ways, but work that also would directly confront corporate powers and government powers, work that we felt would never be carried out pro bono by a corporate law firm and that other organizations, you know, could not do. And we had both looked around and thought, you know, we went to law school believing we wanted to do public interest work and looked around at other groups and other organizations, many of which do quite excellent work, but saw that there was no entity doing what we really wanted to do, and decided right out of law school that we would undertake this very significant effort and start this organization, which we have been successful in doing.
And can you tell us about some of your early cases, then bring us up to the future in terms of the kinds of cases you choose, what it means, for example, when you represent certain kinds of individuals and how you select those?
We have always done constitutional rights, economic justice litigation, and we have over the years brought very significant cases on behalf of people who were subjected to race discrimination, gender discrimination, disability discrimination, discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, against very large corporations as well as the government. And as well, we bring cases, and this has been a significant focus of our practice, on behalf of political activists and organizations across the United States whose work is disrupted, attacked, who are subjected to police brutality and surveillance by both local police agencies, municipalities, as well as the federal government. So a lot of our work is at the intersection of First and Fourth Amendment rights.
Now, I know that a lot of those protest cases go back as far as, I think, year 2000, many of which are in D.C., and that you still have cases pending from World Trade Organization protests in D.C.?
Indeed, we still even have a class action litigation that's pending from the April 2000 IMF World Bank protests, in which the police, working with federal agencies, carried out massive attacks on peaceful protesters over several days, including raiding and seizing the Convergence Center, shutting it down illegally, arresting organizers, carrying out a mass arrest of nearly 700 people who are lawfully protesting on D.C. sidewalks, beatings of people in the street. And the fact that this case has been litigated heavily for 8 years really says a lot about the nature of what we want to do and the kind of work that this is, because the government has drugged this case out for 8 years because they don't want people to take these cases and because they want plaintiffs to give up. They hope that there will be early and toothless settlements or that plaintiffs won't be able to find attorneys who are willing to do these cases at all. We know that liability is established here. In fact, earlier this year, we won before a magistrate judge summary judgment, a recommendation for summary judgment in our favor on the mass arrest of the entire class. And yet these cases are not resolving because the government simply does not want to give up just fighting this out, just a war of attrition.
In New York, during the 2004 Republican National Convention, there were a couple of lawsuits, as I recall, brought by groups who were not given permits to protest on the Great Lawn of Central Park. In fact, one of those groups gave up when the court initially denied their motions. But you stuck in. You had a parallel lawsuit, and you stuck in and indeed have had a great victory in that case.
In New York, as you said, during the 2004 Republican National Convention, Mayor Bloomberg and the police sought to stop people from having the right to assemble on the Great Lawn of Central Park, which in Manhattan is the single location that is hospitable for mass assembly. And instead, we're telling groups that, you know, they could go have these sort of long marches or standing along, you know, lengthy avenues of New York City, but that's far different than being able to have political speech in a rally. They basically want to transform demonstrations into parades without political content. There was one organization that had been denied the right to rally there. They initially accepted the police's recommendation that they go stand on the West Side Highway. There was a lot of opposition from activists and people that want to demonstrate didn't want to do that. And once they did that, other organizations that we were working with, the National Council of Arab Americans and the Answer Coalition, had been planning to have a mass rally on the Great Lawn of Central Park in defense of civil rights and civil liberties for the very targeted Arab and Muslim community in the United States, which has suffered the brunt of extreme repression from this government since 2001. We went into court, sought a preliminary injunction for the right to be able to be in the Great Lawn of Central Park. We lost at the preliminary injunction level. The other organization also went into court. They lost at the preliminary injunction level, but we decided to keep going because we felt we couldn't let the government tell people of New York City and people from around the world who come to New York that they don't have the right to have political speech in the Great Lawn of Central Park. And after several years of litigation, earlier this year, we had a very significant victory in which the government has now had to rescind its regulations with regard to restrictions on the number of people who can be in Central Park. They have been sent back to the drawing board, and we have maintained an informal settlement that we, in fact, will go back into court when they promulgate new regulations if those regulations are not constitutionally sound.
Mara, let's fast forward. After that great victory in getting Central Park returned to the people, you're now fighting for the same principle in D.C. because if it wasn't for you and your lawsuit, the people would be told that they can't attend the inauguration. What's the story down there on this issue?
Well, in D.C., we've been fighting for Pennsylvania Avenue, which is called America's Main Street, running from the Capitol down towards the White House, which is the location of most major demonstrations and parades and marches in the history of Washington, but is where every 4 years you have the quadrennial presidential inaugural parade. And for a number of years, since the National Park Service has had jurisdiction over the area along Pennsylvania Avenue, what has been happening is it's been privatized. So at this presidential inaugural parade, where people come from all over the country because they want to sometimes protest the incoming administration and give their message at this one moment when the president is riding by in the limousine, and other people come just because they want to witness history, they set up bleachers up and down Pennsylvania Avenue and use the bleachers as a political mechanism to restrict access to Pennsylvania Avenue. And this came to a head January 2001 at the beginning of the first Bush administration when groups we were working with wanted to protest the incoming administration, and we had to fight for the right of people engaged in political protest to be along the parade route. And again, in 2005, we had to go into court on an emergency injunction, seeking an emergency injunction, again trying to stop the Bush-Cheney National Park Service from completely privatizing the parade route and trying to stop demonstrators from being along the parade route. Because what they want to do is they want to stage manage democracy. The eyes of the world are on Washington on January 20th every 4 years. And if the president is coming down the parade route and you have thousands and tens of thousands of people protesting Bush and Cheney, they didn't want the world to see it. So we've continued this litigation all of these years, and it's a very interesting turn of events because now you have potentially millions of people coming to Washington because of this historic moment, because you have the first African-American president in history within people's lifetimes who've lived through Jim Crow apartheid in the United States. It's a moment that they can see and their children can see, regardless of what people may think of the Democratic Party or the corporate nature of the Democratic Party, and I think that we have no illusions about what that means. No matter what, this is still a very historical day for people. And because we fought to open up the parade route, it now means that more people are going to be able to come, that tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who otherwise couldn't have stood along the parade route will now be able to on this January 20th.
Mara Verhaelyn-Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice, we want to reintroduce you to our audience. We've been discussing your great victory in D.C. in opening up the parade route to the American people and taking it away from Bush-Cheney Parks Department. But we also wanted to step back and talk about Bush-Cheney. What you believe and we believe has happened over the last almost 8 years has really been historic, that there's been a diminution in democratic rights, a qualitative diminution, we think, and that the bar is being set even lower than it was when W took office in so many respects. And we wanted to get your reflections on where we are now and where we need to go and how we get there.
We've certainly seen a major negation of democratic rights and constitutional rights in the United States under Bush-Cheney these last 8 years. Or perhaps I shouldn't say a negation of constitutional rights, because constitutional rights stand no matter what, but certainly an effort from the government to disrupt, to disrespect, to trash those rights in practice. And I think it's important to recognize that much of what we saw under Bush and Cheney did not begin under Bush and Cheney. It's important to recognize that really since the 70s, since the Church Committee hearings, there's been sort of a ongoing effort to put the police state back into place after the exposure of COINTELPRO and after the exposure of mass violations of people's civil rights in the United States. There was the Church Committee hearings. People had great outrage and uproar over this. The government said, we won't do it again. They put in the Levi guidelines. And then little by little, you can see those being chipped away over the years. Unquestionably, though, when we hit the Bush-Cheney years, and after September 11th, which they were using cynically, not just for their adventurous war on terrorism, but the component part of a shift in domestic policy in the United States in an effort to suppress dissent against the war on terrorism, they went into overdrive. And over these years, there has been just a huge usurpation of government authority, of the government working against people's rights to organize, people's rights to express opposition to the government. And among one of the major things that we've seen and that we've uncovered in discovery and that we're continuing to fight is the creation of this significant surveillance state, essentially a secret police operation against the people of the United States.
Several of the cases you have litigated try to get through the curtain of what has been put in place by the Bush administration. What kinds of legal challenges do you see?
I think, as I was talking about, I think it's important not to have illusions and not to misunderstand where we are because of the Bush-Cheney administration, because in order for us to take the next step, to take the next steps under a new administration, is it enough to say that we want to go back to January 19th, 2001, to just the day before Bush took office, or is there more that we have to do? We have to have an honest assessment of where we are in order to know where we want to go. And when you look at the incoming Obama administration and what we think they're likely to do, there has been, as I said, a creation of a very significant surveillance state, a very significant secret police state. We believe that it is critical that if the Obama administration is serious about restoring people's civil and constitutional rights, that what they must do is immediately engage in an audit of all the federal agencies, federal law enforcement agencies, and their data collection on the people of the United States. There are millions of people in the United States who have done no wrong, many of whom have engaged in free speech activities or religious activities, and simply by effect of those lawful activities are now entered into government law enforcement databases. We think there has to be an audit of every agency's databases to determine exactly what the databases are, to identify what has been collected, where it has been put, who has access to that information, to tell people of the United States individually what has been collected on them, and then to expunge it. Because for people in the United States to have their government collecting information, maintaining information on these massive database files that can be used by law enforcement that gets pulled up at a moment's notice is really a very dangerous practice. It is a secret police practice. And what they're doing is they have misused existing databases and data tools, databases like high-intensity drug trafficking area databases, violent gang and terrorist organization file, and many other types of databases that were created and authorized solely to address specific issues like drugs, like terrorism, but instead are putting law-abiding people in those databases or people that have engaged solely in protest activity and First Amendment activity. It has to end. They have to stop it. They have to tell us what they have. They have to tell us who's in it. And then they have to take those people out and take this information out and wipe it clean.
In many of your lawsuits, and one that comes to mind is the group of individuals dressed in black who police followed into a parking garage and then proceeded to ask personal questions about their political affiliations and associations. In that lawsuit, you challenged that police tactic, arresting people based on the perception that they were, in this case, anarchists, then went ahead and asked them information that is really improper to ask.
That's right. In that lawsuit, which is titled the Bulger case, but the folks in the case refer to themselves as the Stir Fry because they had left a lawful protest. They'd gone back to their car and garage. They were eating stir fry from the car when suddenly there was this mass assault from police charging down the garage, arresting them all, interrogating them. For years, the police lied about who was there. We were able to establish that FBI was also on the scene, that undercover FBI agents, it appears, had infiltrated the protest. These folks had done nothing wrong. They were subjected to an illegal mass arrest and then interrogated about their beliefs, their associations, their political beliefs, where they had been, who they were staying with. They were asked to roll up their shirts, sleeves, and pull up their shirts and show tattoos. They were asked to show piercings. These things were being filmed. They were collecting information on their political slogans and, you know, slogans on their shirts and political literature. So there's no basis in anything that pretends to be a free society. But this isn't the only case where we have this. We've been able to establish that these mass arrests that have been conducted, and we're handling two large class actions, one of 400 and one of 700 people in different incidents in D.C., that these mass arrests are used as massive intelligence gathering operations by the government, not just local police, but the federal government, that people's names are collected, that their associations and identity with political activity is collected. This is some of the information that we want to demand an end to, but I think the collection of information is so much broader than that. But here's the challenge that we face. The fact is, and I think that, you know, in terms of the issue of not having illusions as we move forward now, because there is a lot of hope from people that there will be change, for there to be change, we have to understand what the stakes are and what the realities are. The Obama administration is going to be faced with the usual sort of threat from the right wing, and in this, you know, based on the war on terrorism or the threat of terrorism. And if Obama lifts this mass intrusion into people's lives, lifts and eliminates this vast Fourth Amendment and First Amendment violations of people's privacy and people's rights, that would require him to expend political capital that I think realistically he is not going to be willing to expend. I mean, you can imagine the meetings with Rahm Emanuel, with assumably the Attorney General Eric Holder, who used to be the U.S. Attorney in D.C. during some of these early protests that we're still litigating. And he's going to want to shield himself from right-wing attacks, the right-wing attacks that would say, if there is a terrorist attack or something happens to the United States and you have altered the police state at all, then that's your fault. And the easiest way to defend against the sort of threat of the right-wing on this constant, omnipresent threat of if there is a terrorist attack is to not alter the police state. I think that their desire is going to be not to alter the police state at all. And the one way that it will happen is if there is a mass public demand and opposition, which is why we are launching a campaign at the Partnership for Civil Justice along the lines of what I was talking about before, of people joining with the partnership in this massive demand from below that the databases be identified, that the information that's been collected be identified, that we learn the breadth of access and disclosure, and that there be expungement. That's the only way that it's really going to happen, is a massive campaign coming from people. And historically, if you think, you know, under the Clinton administration, and really ever since the late 70s, liberal public opinion has always been fearful of the right wing and attacks coming from the right wing. And because of that fear, people so often then ultimately end up embracing a right-wing agenda. Like you say, well, I don't want to get attacked if there ends up, you know, being some terrible thing that happens, and so therefore we can't dismantle the police state because we're afraid of the right wing. Well, then you end up completely embracing the right-wing police state agenda. And you think about it with Clinton. You know, he kicked 7 million kids off welfare in, you know, a snap of the fingers overnight. He enacted the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which negated habeas and introduced secret evidence under a Democratic president. And people didn't fight in mass numbers because there was this constant, omnipresent assertion that were you to criticize, were you to fight, that it would support the right wing.
Mara, what's your website at the Partnership for Civil Justice? We want to link up to it, and we want our audience to be able to grab their pen and pencils and write it down.
It's www.justiceonline.org. That's justiceonline, all one word, .org. We urge people to come to the website. We are launching this new campaign to end the secret police state and expunge and expose the files. And we want people from all around the country to join us in this demand. That is the way that it will happen.
You've talked to us in the past on Law and Disorder about the number of lawsuits that you've brought, and many of which are still pending from eight years ago, a lot of them involving protesters who've been gathered up, from whom political information has been taken and arguably put into different databases or kept on file somewhere. With the change in administration, it sounds, from what you've said, that you don't expect any speedy resolution if, in fact, the government wants to prolong these as long as possible to discourage other people from bringing this kind of lawsuit?
I don't know. You can never know exactly what political determinations people will make. But from our perspective, we prepare every case and bring every case for trial. And we intend to take these cases to trial unless we can get a fair resolution for all of the people that have suffered these extreme abuses at the hands of law enforcement authority. So that's the direction we're going. If it's possible to resolve these, we would resolve them, but in the absence of fair resolution, people will have their fair day in court.
What's been your impression so far of the various appointments that the Obama administration has been making?
Well, I think they're very telling. I mean, there's been great discussion about change we need and change we can believe in. I can't say that Rahm Emanuel would fall into that category, nor at this point, you know, could we say that Eric Holder does, or really any of the people you see them bandying about for these major positions. It's all these folks that, you know, have been brought back from the Clinton administration, and we don't know how many, you know, other people that they're going to bring in that are Republicans. It's ultimately a center-right kind of lineup. I think it's important to recognize that. And Rahm Emanuel, you know, certainly when it comes to issues of Palestinian self-determination and justice for the people of Palestine, is a very, very concerning appointee. I mean, his father was a member of the Irgun, you know, which was a terrorist organization.
I'll do you one better. His father named him, Rahm, after a guy in the Lehi, which were the Stern Gang,
yeah.
Which was even worse than the Irgun.
Yes. I mean, this is reasonably concerning for people. I mean, what does that say for the people of Palestine? What does that reasonably say? The one thing that has happened is that so many people are now engaging in political activity, even if it was, you know, going to the voting booth because they've been told, and honestly in many cases lied to, that that is the single act of democratic participation in the United States there is. But there is so much hope that there has to be an answer to that hope. And I think there's many, many people that want to see change, that believe the words when they hear that, you know, they are the change they've been looking for. The issue is now what will happen if this administration, as I think we can expect, is not going to have the major changes and the hope that people are yearning for in the United States. How will those things come about? They will come about the way they have always historically come about, which is from a mass people's movement coming from the ground up. And that, I think, is the hope that we all have at this point, that we can see that's what's coming. And that's what, you know, within the Partnership for Civil Justice's work, you know, our our view is that we want to keep the streets open and the sidewalks open and the parklands open for democracy, for people's right to be in the streets, to demand what is just and what is fair.
Mara Verhalen Hilliard, well said.
Again, a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder, and we greatly look forward to seeing what happens at the inauguration. Thank you and Carl and the partnership for your important litigation and freeing it up for the public.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. We're happy to have back on Law and Disorder attorney and union activist Daniel Gross, who has co-written with Stoughton Lind the recently published Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, Building Solidarity While Staying Clear of the Law. It's called a guerrilla legal handbook and a practical guide for workers to make their work environment a better place while reinvigorating the labor movement. There are models demonstrating how to build, quote, solidarity unionism and use direct action to win. In this book, there are cases on fundamental labor rights and building grassroots solidarity across borders. Daniel, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
I just want to describe for our audience, because we're not on TV yet, Daniel Gross is sitting here in a beautiful orange T-shirt that says Shut Down Guantanamo on the front in black letters, and on the back it says Stop Torture. Daniel, your dress is as profound as your newest book, and we want to talk to you about yourself and about your book.
But first, Daniel, in case listeners don't remember, you've been very active in a campaign to unionize Starbucks across the country and had some great successes. Can you tell us how that work led into your new co-authorship of this book and also what else you're doing right now?
Sure. Well, the Starbucks campaign now is as active and really successful as it's been. We're in a great moment now. Baristas around the country are taking direct action around issues of concern, everything from store closures with inadequate severance to very insecure work hours. Starbucks is led once again by its chairman. He's taken back the CEO role, and he's been making some very, very anti-worker policy changes. There's a new scheduling program which forces workers to really rest open their availability to work. They have to essentially be open to work over 80 hours a week, and still we're not guaranteed any number of work hours. So, I mean, there's just been really exciting actions, you know, in the Twin Cities. They've been doing incredible work around, you know, everything from, again, from store closures to security issues in a store. The baristas recently at a store in Minneapolis collected 500 signatures from workers, community members, and customers saying this particular store has a lot of security problems and improvements need to be made. So the campaign, it's going quite well. You can still check it out at StarbucksUnion.org. You know, from my personal perspective, starting now close to 10 years ago working in retail, I was actually at Borders Books and Music. I was propelled from that experience into the labor movement and into the industrial workers of the world. And then following that up with working at Starbucks and being confronted with the issues there and, frankly, seeing the inadequacy of the traditional trade union model in the United States for retail and fast food workers. I was one of the early folks in on the campaign at Starbucks, which started in 2004. And from there, ended up collaborating with Staunton on a journal article and now the book.
Thanks, Daniel. We're talking about the book, Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, Building Solidarity While Staying Clear of the Law. Daniel Gross, Staunton Lind are the authors of the book. But before we get into that, what was it that brought you to where you are? You went to law school. You're a union organizer. Tell us a little bit personally about how you got to where you're at today.
Well, like many rank-and-file organizers, I was confronted with very hostile union busting from various companies, and that actually propelled me into law school and did the law school thing and currently do organizing with a legal component, you can say. Anyone that's done organizing knows that the law, as it's currently formulated, is actually an extremely negative thing. And one of the things I love about the book is actually its subtitle, Building Solidarity While Staying Clear of the Law. I think one would be hard-pressed to find many books about the law which takes a frankly, on balance, pretty negative view of what it can do for you. A lot of what Staunton and I do is try to show how the law can repress and co-opt solidarity amongst rank-and-file workers. But to be fair, there are some areas where the law can offer protection when it's combined with real strong solidarity on the shop floor and direct action.
Give us an idea of the kind of the fundamental premises of the book and how that would contrast with your typical bureaucratic labor leader.
You know, really what the book is all about is the belief that Staunton and I share that fundamentally it's the rank and file which possesses the real power to transform both work and society. For too long, unionism in the United States has been focused on either government certification or employer recognition. What Staunton and I argue is that a union is a group of workers standing together to take direct action. Now, we shouldn't let either the employer or the government define whether we're a labor union or not. What Staunton and I do then is de-emphasize the certification provisions of Section 9 of the Labor Act and emphasize what workers can find in terms of protection in Section 7 in terms of collective activity.
One thing that I found very interesting is the myth that when organizing immigrants, for example, that they're going to be afraid to stand up and confront the powers that be. From your experience, is that the case?
Heidi, you've hit it right on the head. It is a myth, absolutely. And one of the really exciting things about the book is that we've, in addition to comprehensively revising it, Staunton and I have included a whole new section called Practicing Solidarity Unionism, and hopefully we get a chance to talk about this concept of solidarity unionism as well. But one of the chapters is called No One Is Illegal. It lays out the legal framework in which organizing amongst immigrants, documented, undocumented, non-immigrant workers takes place. And the message of the chapter is that absolutely there are certainly barriers in the law to organizing, and in many ways undocumented immigrants are treated like second-class citizens. But despite all that, the right to form a labor union for workers regardless of status remains intact. And in fact, many of the most profound and exciting organizing campaigns across the country are taking place among immigrant workers, documented and undocumented. So I reject out of hand this notion that workers with different immigration statuses are afraid to organize. It's oftentimes quite the opposite, because the exploitation is so great and so much was risked to come to this country. Oftentimes you'll actually see a tremendous willingness to stand up and fight back.
Daniel Gross, author of this wonderful book, Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, Building Solidarity While Staying Clear of the Law. Daniel Gross, you've had your book published by a press that I'm just becoming familiar with, PM Press out of Oakland, California. What was the reason that you and Staunton Lind wanted to get this book out? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, Staunton and I have witnessed, both in our own ways, the tremendous resilience and intelligence and initiative of the rank and file on the shop floor. And we've also witnessed political and trade union bureaucrats getting in the way of rank-and-file dissent and radical upsurges on the shop floor. In our own ways, we feel very, very strongly about the fundamental role of rank-and-file initiatives in social change, the initiative of everyday working people. I want to point out, in the current economic crisis, I think there's a lot of opportunities for rank-and-file upsurges. You know, we as working people have long suffered indignities at work, difficulties making ends meet, paying off debt, paying rent. But this time is a little bit different because, frankly, the filthy hands of the corporations are just all over this mess. And as I go around the country talking about the book, I meet more and more working folks and their families who really have a keen understanding that, you know, this economic collapse is not a force of nature, which is a favorite ideological message of the opposition. This is something that was created by corporations, which is just the current form of organization favored by capitalists today. And one thing that concerns me is seeing lately on Capitol Hill, whether it's the hedge fund gurus or the auto CEOs, capital seems and is willing to make some accommodations to avoid a radical upswing. And I think we'll also find that we'll see the fist of repression as well in an effort to avoid a fundamental transformation of society. And one of the beautiful things about rank-and-file initiative and grassroots change is it's not as subject to co-optation as change led by a leadership which is unaccountable and undemocratic. So I just think this is our time for folks that are workplace organizers or community organizers or tenant organizers to really get out there and step up the organizing around transformational demands, not just piecemeal reforms, not just a little bit more of the pie, but demands which both spark more collective activity and also question the fundamental role of the corporations in our lives.
Yeah, that's, I think, the absolutely crucial subject. How do we get people from where they are to where they should be? And my kind of schema for it is that there are democratic demands that you make to, like, roll back all the police state stuff, for example, or permission to attend the inaugural with your own protest sign. There are democratic demands. There are demands for reform, like increase the minimum wage, free college education for everybody, or nationalized health program. But then there's another kind of demands, and this is what I think you're talking about, Daniel. And those are transitional demands that really encroach upon the prerogatives of the capitalist class. And one such demand that was famous in the 30s during the last huge labor upsurge was the demand to end unemployment. You want a 30-hour work week, but be paid for 40 hours so that everybody has a job. That's a demand that makes sense, but a demand that people that own and rule this country really don't want to give. But it really plants one foot in the present and one foot in the future. Is that what you had in mind when you were talking about these kinds of demands?
Yeah, I think that's all, you know, tremendous analysis there. And I think we share the same view of looking at reforms and assessing whether they're just a little bit more of the pie or do they, the way I phrase it is, do they invigorate more collective activity? And do they, challenge the role of corporations in our lives? You know, I think a tremendous example out there right now are the demands for foreclosure moratoriums. Those not only give an obvious benefit to homeowners who were, you know, tricked into these ridiculous explosive mortgages, but they also question the absolute right of private property. They challenge that idea that property is something that's just inviolable and no other rights can compete with it. And some other demands regarding debt, I think, are tremendous demands, whether consumer debt or student debt. You know, we have people walking around, talking to them all the time as I go around talking about the book, who are just saddled with mountains of debt. You know, we talk about debt relief for countries, and that's wonderful. I'm a big supporter of that. But how about some debt relief for individuals in the United States?
How about it?
Well, I actually wanted to step back a second and ask if you could give a few examples to help our listeners understand the difference between, I guess you would call it, more traditional union model and that of solidarity unionism?
Absolutely. Well, the business union model is the idea that a union is similar to other service providers. That is, the consumer pays a fee, and in return for that fee, a service is provided. In the case of the mainstream trade unions, that service is representation. In the solidarity union model, workers themselves actually control and operate their own campaigns. And instead of working for their demands through representatives, workers take direct action against their employer around issues of concern. And another just really important difference between solidarity unionism and the mainstream model is the question of organizing with or without a majority. Because the bureaucratic model requires for its revenue stream to get what's known as a dues checkoff clause, they need a majority certification. If you're in a workplace where your particular unit is only fortunate to have, say, 49% support, the trade unions aren't interested. As Stoughton puts it in the book, you know, the organizer checks out of the motel and leaves out of town. And the workers who support the union are just left, you know, to be subject to retaliation and discrimination by the boss. In solidarity unionism, sure, majorities are great, wonderful. But you know what? 49% of a workplace, and to be frank, a handful of workers on the shop floor that are speaking out publicly, that are challenging the boss, that are a resource that other coworkers can go to, that's a real power on the shop floor, and that results in majorities at some point down the line. You know, we really emphasize that just because you can't get into a government-certified arrangement, assuming you want to, you may not want to, this idea that you're not a labor union is really counterproductive and goes back to this idea that it's the employer or the government that tells you whether you're a union or not.
Daniel Gross, the author of Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, Building Solidarity While Staying Clear of the Law. Daniel and Stoughton Lind have written this really important book. PM Press put it out. I think it's also available through the IWW website, isn't it, Daniel?
Yes, the IWW has a lit department, a literature department, and they have a web store, and you can get to it through IWW.org.
Daniel, can you tell us about your plans for the future? Writing anything else?
Well, you know, I do some writing from time to time. I'm actually an organizer, so I'm in the trenches and don't do as much writing as maybe I might like. Who knows down the line? But I do work for a nonprofit organization called Brand Workers. We protect and advance the right of low-wage retail and food employees. And our major organizing initiative right now is called Focus on the Food Chain. And what Focus on the Food Chain does is it promotes the idea that a sustainable food system must include respect for workers' human rights. And we're currently campaigning against what was formerly the number one rated seafood retailer and wholesaler in New York City, a company called Wild Edibles Incorporated, which exploits immigrants from Latin America, Peruvians, Colombians, Mexicans, and a couple folks from Honduras. You know, they come in at 2 a.m., they work around the clock to get the seafood cut up and prepared and packed and delivered. They've been denied overtime for 15 years. They're consistently yelled at and infantilized by management. And what's remarkable is the workers have built a grassroots campaign to really assert their voice in the public arena and on the shop floor. One thing they've done is they've, through grassroots advocacy, persuaded over 45 of New York's top fine dining restaurants to stop purchasing seafood from Wild Edibles. And it's been wonderful seeing the workers develop their skills, organizing skills, communicating about legal rights with coworkers, and speaking out on the streets in the grassroots. And so we're very determined to see the campaign through to victory. You know, the workers need to come to work every day and have their dignity respected.
Has there been retaliation by Wild Edibles?
Yeah, as in most cases, when workers stand up for their rights, there has been really egregious retaliation. 12 workers have been fired or forced out for standing up for their rights. And, you know, the corporations are dominating our economic, cultural, social, and political life. And I think there's a rising awareness of that fact, you know, that whether it comes to our political system or the media we consume or the air we breathe or the water we drink, the hands of the corporations are all over the place. And this bailout and economic crisis and just tremendous theft of people's resources, I think, is really going to create an opportunity for us, has created, in fact, an opportunity for those of us interested in transformative change to start increasing our organizing on the shop floor, in the community, as tenants, around transformative demands for change.
Daniel, there's a section in the book that actually enumerates several specific rights of workers. And I think it's always interesting to hear a couple of those that some people may either take for granted or be surprised at.
Well, really, one of the best kept secrets in American labor law is that whether you're engaging in union activity or whether you're just engaging in general collective activity, there is protection for that kind of grassroots activity on the shop floor. And some of the things we go into in the book are, for example, when workers are concerned about something on the job.
Like the heat.
Like the heat. Or to give an example from my work life, concerned about rat and insect infestation at Starbucks, you know, what do you do about it? Well, one thing you can do is have a press conference. And this is news to a lot of folks that you don't need to go and, you know, beg the employer to fix the problem. You might want to tell them to fix it, but if they don't, no matter what the issue is, why not have a press conference? As long as it involves, you know, coworkers, it's not an individual tactic, and you're talking about your wages or working conditions, which is pretty broadly defined under the case law, you can have your press conference and talk about the issue. At Starbucks, in this particular case, we accumulated video and photographs of the rats and insects and had the press conference. We were joined by a 25 or 30-foot inflatable rat to symbolize the real rats on the inside of the 44 New York City Starbucks had either rat or insect violations. And it was wonderful. We got quite a good response from management, although they were furious, the management officials actually did run to the shops and
get mousetraps.
Well, it's mostly structural improvements. You know, there was holes in the floorboards and things of that nature, and those things were very quickly remedied. So that's one of the nice direct action stories we talk about in the book. And, you know, we go into a lot of things which you might be surprised you can get away with. I mean, things like marching into work with a group of your coworkers during the rush period and serving listed demands on your manager. If you can be creative about it and collective, and it has to do with your wages and working conditions, there's quite a bit that workers can do to hold management accountable on the job.
And the law protects them.
Well, to the extent that you've done your homework and you've built real solidarity and you have a compelling campaign, then the law can offer some added protection.
If listeners would like to read in depth about more of those examples, and I'm sure many of you will, the book is titled Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, Building Solidarity While Staying Clear of the Law. It's by Daniel Gross and Stoughton Lind. You can get copies of the book through pmpress.org or through the Literature Department at iww.org.
Daniel Gross, thanks a million for being on Law and Disorder.
Daniel, it's always a pleasure.
It's been great. Thank you for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.